This week in Retronauts, a look at the competition. I'm kidding. It's not the competition. I'm not fostering that. That's a joke. It's just a joke. It's not true. And that's not to say they're not good, because they're great. I love it. What am I talking about? Retro Gamer Magazine. I find that quite hard to say for some reason. Retro Gamer Magazine. Yeah, I'm not editing that out. I want you all to know. Anyway, this is one of my interview episodes. I'm Stuart Jipp, incidentally, in case you hadn't figured that out. who else is it going to be? And I spoke to Darren Jones, the editor of Retro Gamer Magazine, who has been such an editor for 20 plus years now, since the magazine moved to Imagine Publishing. It was originally with Live Publishing, but that caught fire and fell down. Now they're with Future Publishing. They've moved around quite a lot, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the magazine. We're going to talk about putting together the magazine. We're going to talk about what's in the magazine, how the magazine gets made. I think that's just really the same as putting together the magazine, but the history of the magazine, all sorts of things about the magazine Retro Gamer, which you really should be reading if you're not. I think if you listen to Retronauts, it's probably relevant to your interests, because, you know, retro gaming, come on, it's similar to what we do here. I won't ramble on anymore. This has already gone on far too long. I'm just going to hand straight over to, I suppose, myself and Darren, who really, I hope, gets most of the airtime here, or I'm not doing my job very well. That remains to be seen. Enjoy. I guess a good place to start would be, how did you get here? How did you get into, like, magazines, into retro gaming?
Luck. I typically always say. I mean, I didn't have a conventional start. I went to school. I left school at 15. Didn't have incredible grades, and I ended up working full time in Gateway, which is an old defunct supermarket chain, because that's where I used to work part-time, so it seemed to make sense to, like, you know, carry on doing that. And graduated to the big leagues in Tesco. Yeah. And then I went into insurance. Yeah. And I think it was during that period that I started writing for our company's magazine. Nothing major. I was just doing, like, little mini game reviews and little DVD reviews and things like that. And at this point, I started writing for a website called GameStyle. So I think the website's still around now. Most of my content, thankfully, isn't. And
it's been expunged. Yeah, that's the dream, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of the good things about, obviously, writing for the internet, that can hopefully disappear. Yeah. So when you're like writing a review of Project Zero and doing it from a first-person perspective of the girl I'm exploring the house, all of that is gone, so that's great. But you know what it's like when you're a writer, you're trying to find your style and everything like that, and you do all sorts of crazy things. So I was writing for GameStyle, and after a while, because I wanted to review better games, I thought, well, if I get in touch with, like, the PRs and stuff, I can start handling the game reviews and choosing the better games for myself. So I started doing that, and I think before I started on GameStyle, they had about 50 to 100 reviews, and then by the time I finished at GameStyle, that had, like, doubled or tripled.
Yeah.
So I did a really good job of basically getting hold of stuff for them. And then I saw that XBM, which was a magazine I really liked, they were actually based in Bournemouth at Paragon Publishing, and I really liked the idea of writing for them. So I went for an interview. I didn't get it, but I did get offered a job on GamesTM as their news editor, which I probably wasn't the right person for it, but I think because I'd had such good PR contacts, with people at the time. They obviously thought I'd be perfect for news. And so I went on to Games TM, really struggled for the first few months because ultimately I wasn't used to writing to spec and writing to deadlines and like you need to do 500 words by X amount of time and all the rest. And it was a real struggle. And
that's Games TM, Imagine Publishing, who took over Retro Gamer from Live Publishing, right?
Yeah, so basically...
In 2005, I want to say? 7, maybe?
Yeah, it was 2005. So basically, I'd moved on to Games TM's retro section after the retro editor left the company.
Yeah.
And I was doing that from around issue 18, although I was doing like small bits contributing to it anyway.
Mm.
And then when I got asked by Simon Phillips, who was the main editor-in-chief at Imagine, he was like, do you know what John Szczepaniak's email address is? I said, why do you want to get a hold of John Szczepaniak? And he was like, because I want to see if he'd be interested in being a staff writer on Retro Gamer, because we've bought it. And it was like, well, why the fuck are you not asking me? I want to do that. And he was like, oh, no, we want you to be the editor. So I didn't have an interview or anything. I was just asked if I wanted to do it. Got given, was told one price that it would pay. And then obviously when I agreed to it, it then turned out to be $3,000 less, but, you know, the magazine publishing.
Yeah.
I got asked to be in charge of the relaunch. And that happened from issue 19, and I've been on the mag ever since. And it's what 286? No, 287. We're currently working on.
Yeah, geez, I remember when 200 came out. It seems like yesterday, to be honest. That's actually quite jarring. So that's what, like 22 years this year?
Yeah. So the magazine.
And you've been on it for 20 minimum, like now.
Yes. Yeah, so the magazine came out in January 2004.
Yeah.
When it was under Live Publishing, it was originally going to be a quarterly magazine.
Mm.
Then decided to push that to a bi-monthly magazine, and then because it was so successful, it just went monthly.
Mm.
So I've been on Retro Gamer since November 2005. Our first issue came out, I think, December the 5th, 2005. So it'll be my 21st year on the mag this November, which is pretty mad.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it's almost. I mean, it's not unprecedented. Is it unprecedented in games? In games writing?
It's definitely not unprecedented when you look at the world, because I do believe that somebody on one of the US mags was working on it for about 24, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not aware of any gaming editor who has ever worked on a UK magazine for that length of time.
Yeah.
So you could either look at it as being really impressive or my inability to move on within the company. But I love what I do.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I remember, if you don't mind me interjecting this, actually, I remember like seeing the second issue, and it was the second issue. I didn't see the first issue on the shelves of my local newsagent. I think I was 18 when that started, and I was just like, because I was already into retro gaming through things like classicgaming.com. Forums, that sort of thing, and ROMs, and the, as listeners will know, my upbringing when I didn't have anything that was just ROMs. That was all I had, basically. So I'm just in the past all the time. I remember seeing this magazine and just being like, oh, they've made a magazine that has a readership of me. Like that's this is exactly the sort of thing I'm interested in. And I just, in fact, I'll thank you, even though I'm not sure if it was your decision, but I did subscribe really late into the Live Publishing era. So I got one issue, I think, and then they went into admin. So I was like, great, there goes my like 40 quid or whatever. But then I want to thank you personally for giving me 6 issues of the Imagine one. You didn't have to do that, but you did. And I'm very grateful for transferring my subscription over. So thank you for that. So
that absolutely wouldn't have been me, but
take the credit anyway, because you're who's here. So I'm going to give you the credit for it. But yeah, I think I will ask, because listeners who possibly aren't familiar with it, well, you gave the sort of potted history there, but So live publishing, Martin Carroll was editor before on the live version of the magazine, and I know they were around for the Imagine one. So did they sort of liaise with you about how it was going to move forward, or?
Yeah, so my understanding is that obviously Life Publishing, for whatever various reasons, closed down.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to Martin at the CG show that was happening, and they were all gutted. They didn't know what was happening with the mag. I think at that point they even had issue 19, and it was all finished and hadn't gone to press. And then Imagine Publishing just bought it, and my understanding is that they bought the rights to the magazine as well as all the old content. And I don't know if Martin was offered the position or not to continue. He was based up in Stoke-on-Trent, so as far as I'm aware, you know, I was just asked to start editing the mag, and that's what happened.
Mm.
Although, obviously, you know, I always made a point to, whenever we hit big milestones in the mag, like 50th issue, 100th issue, I always made a point to, like, thank Martin and the rest of the Life Publishing team, because ultimately, without them, I wouldn't be doing what I love now. And in a nice twist of fate, Martin is now back with us as features editor, which he's been doing for the last couple of months, so he's kind of come full circle.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I do remember when it came back. I remember thinking, and forgive me for the cynicism, but I remember thinking, how long is this going to be around for? And you know, if I'd have put money on it, I would have lost money. So
same here. I had us down for issue 35 before we ran out of ideas. So what do I know? Not a lot.
So I guess I should ask, really, what is the process like sort of every issue? What's the general, has it changed at all over the years? Like, have things noticeably become easier or more difficult? Or?
Yeah, so what I try to do now is, if you look at any issue of the mag, you'll find that it's kind of like a journey through time. So once you've got the news stories out the way, you start off with like the 8-bit stuff, and then it will move through to 16, 32-bit. So the idea is that every issue, you're kind of like taking a journey.
Yeah.
Whereas when we first did the magazine, and I don't know if this was more to do with the fact that I wasn't, you know, I'd never done a proper editor's job. I'd never been in charge of an entire magazine before Retro Gamer. I'd normally just done a section, like the news section or the retro section. And I used to just do stuff higgledy-piggledy. And my reasoning behind that at the time was like, well, this is probably going to be more exciting to the reader because you don't know what you're going to get. Like, maybe you'll be reading a Spectrum article, and then you're going to go into a PS2 article, and then you're going to go to an 8-bit arcade article.
Yeah.
So I thought that was the better way. But I feel that this is a more, it tells more of a story, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, so just in case listeners don't know this, and also because I'm curious, to be honest, because I've never actually done this. What does the editor do? Like, what is the editor's day on this magazine?
Right then. So generally, I'm in charge of basically deciding what content goes in the mag, and I'll have a discussion with Martin, and we'll look at all the pictures that we've received, and we'll look at the kind of things that we're short on, and we'll choose pictures, obviously, based on the quality of them, based on how interesting they are, and based on whether they fit in the general flow of the mag. So there might be some times where we'll be sent, I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 PS2 articles. And it's too many because we don't want the magazine to feel too like one genre heavy. So we might say, well, we'll take this one and we'll run these at a later date. So I'll have general day-to-day discussions with Martin. I'll be looking at, obviously, articles that come in. I'll be writing my own pieces, although I don't write to the level that I used to. It's very rare I do a cover feature, for example, simply because there are plenty of other people who are far better writers than I are who can write those articles. So I'm generally doing the smaller bits. I'll be doing reviews. I'll be proofing stuff when it comes in. And then generally the kind of production line we have, as it were, is that a piece will get written. I'll take a look at it. I will then put it through to our production editor. He will check it for additional errors, libel, anything like that. It will then go to Andy, our designer. Andy will then design it. Once it's been designed, it will go back to Tim, our production editor, who will give it another check through. And then sometimes you might have to tidy up things, like there might be overflow and various other bits that he will sort out. And then it will come back to me and I'll give it a couple more readovers. And then if it's a feature, I'll send it over to Martin so he can put his eyes over it. And otherwise, it's ready to PDF. And then you obviously look at a PDF and then it's sent. So it sounds really simple.
It
sounds a bit boring because you are looking at a lot of text in that. You know, I don't want to say that making magazines is anything like making movies. But one of the things that you hear from actors is that obviously they rarely watch their films because, you know, they do a lot of repetition through like takes and all the rest.
Yeah.
And apart from a cursory glance to make sure that there's nothing major in the issue, I very rarely reread issues because you kind of like you're tied in particularly more with like memories of either things that were difficult to achieve or
Covers
that didn't work out well. That doesn't happen as often now because working at Future is very different from working at Imagine. But yeah, you tend to like because you're looking at stuff so often. You don't tend to like dwell on stuff,
yeah,
because you're always looking forward.
If you don't mind me asking, I was going to say yes. You're with Future now. You've been with Future a few years now. How long now have you been with Future Publishing?
I think it's a decade now.
Oh, is it? Good God! Yeah. Okay, wow.
I know it's that whole thing of time passes way too quickly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm curious when you said that it was different from Imagine. I'm just curious about that, or is it different in sort of uninteresting bureaucratic ways? Or
I mean, the culture at Imagine was very different. I mean, I won't dwell on it. There's enough stories out there, and some of the challenges that we used to have with regards to like cover meetings simply aren't a thing anymore. So you can just get on and make as good a mag as you possibly can without. Without being, I don't want to say hindered, because ultimately everybody at Imagine always had the best interest all the management wanted the magazines to be as good as possible. But there's obviously ways you can manage, and some ways are more effective than others.
I think I can get the gist from that. It's good. It seems like a better sort of position to be in.
You're just allowed to basically make the mag.
Yeah.
And it just makes things a lot easier.
Speaking for myself, I found like when I have pitched things, when I have produced things for the magazine, which is a while back now, I have found it with Future just really smooth and easy. Like getting that stuff in, getting it sorted. I've been quite impressed.
And also, they just have like a good back end as well with regards to like obviously how the hub works and just like submitting things and all the rest. So I had a very good time at Imagine. You know, they took a huge gamble on me giving me the mag, and if I didn't like it there, I wouldn't still be there. I would have left, but ultimately it's one of those things where you see different styles of way companies have run, and you're like, oh yeah, I much prefer this way compared to that way.
So going back a bit, I mean, we're talking of future publishing, because to me, just speaking for myself, it was a thrill getting something in, not just to Retro Gamer, but to Future, because to me, that's what I, Sega Power, that's what I grew up reading, you know. I'm curious what your sort of gaming sort of lineage is and the magazines that you read back in the day, if any.
Okay, well, I hung out in arcades a lot when I was a youngster, partly because my dad would take me to gigs, so there would typically be like a couple of arcade machines in whatever bar or club he was at.
Yeah.
So I always got to play arcade games from a young age. I didn't get my own first computer until I was 14, and I got an Amstrad for my birthday. Before that, I would play lots of Spectrum, Commodore 64, because my friends would have them. And I would typically go around their house after school and or at school, because there was one guy called Richard Tallboys who literally lived across the road from the school. So at lunchtimes, we'd be able to go to his house and we'd play like Jet Set Willy, Spy Hunter, whatever it is he had. So that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
A few of my friends had Atari 2600, so I'd play on those. But you know what it's like when you're growing up. You are very limited via money and just via whose houses you can get to and what they have. So your gaming knowledge doesn't really expand until, you know, you can start buying your own stuff and discovering new things. So after the Amstrad, I quickly graduated over to the Master System, because like I said, I finished work when I was school when I was 15. So I was working full time, getting the pricely sim of £65 a week, and I would put that towards Master System games. I would pretty much spend all my money on video games. I mean, I think out of that 65 quid, I would give my mum 35, and then the rest was mine. And I then went up to the Mega Drive, which I got as an import machine, and I've been pretty much importing video games since I was 17, so I am a bit of a snob when it comes to PAL games from that era, because most of them were pretty atrocious.
And
I learned pretty quickly that you did not play PAL games, because most of them just weren't very good.
Yeah, I didn't have exposure to NTSC until years later, but I won't go back. I refuse to go back, even for nostalgia.
Yeah, a lot of people do, and you know, I never openly criticize somebody who's like a PAL collector or something, because most people tend to want to play the games that they grew up with and experience the games in the way that they did. But one of the things that I've always found very interesting, and I've never been able to wrap my head around, is that typically when people like watching movies or listening to music, they'll very rarely watch a VHS over a 4K or a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
They'll happily play like the PAL version of GoldenEye over the NTSC one.
Yeah.
So I've never understood that, but because it just seems to contradict, like you want the best image possible for this, but you're quite happy to play this with a terrible frame rate.
Mm.
But you know, everyone each to their own, and it would be pretty boring if we all liked the same stuff.
Where were you importing from, out of curiosity, back then?
So we used to have a place in Bournemouth called the Video Game Center, and it was a great little shop run by a guy called Martin. And he initially started off in his parents' pram shop. He had like a little section of their shop, and as his stuff became more popular, and as import gaming and console gaming in general took off, he moved to a bigger and bigger store. And then I think Martin sold the business just before the PS3 came along. I think he could see that the writing was on the wall for independent game shops. And although it continued on, it just wasn't working, because like people like myself, I stopped buying from them because it was really hard to pay like £60 on a PS3 game when you could get it from Lixang for like 30 quid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you want to go and support small businesses, but when they're paying double the amount that you can get online, it's like, you know, your altruism only goes so far. And ultimately it was, you know, it's too much money.
Yeah, that's interesting because I've been not to contradict that, of course, it's because that's true. But I've been writing about the Super Nintendo recently, and in the research I've been doing, it's been occasionally you get these anomalies like Street Fighter 2 being available on import for like 20 quid cheaper than it ever was when it was officially released, and it sort of makes me wish I'd been around for it. It just seems like an interesting scene, but
it was an exciting time. I mean, yeah. I remember paying £120 for Star Fox.
Oh, worth it every penny. Yeah.
Whereas, and I think I'm pretty sure that at the time you could actually get a Super Nintendo over here for like 99 quid.
Mm.
But yeah, generally, I just wanted the games and I wanted them ASAP. And you know, you often had huge windows before a game came out. Like I remember getting Super Star Wars. I paid 70 quid for it. I got it Christmas Eve and I'd completed it by Boxing Day, but I still, you know, I still thought it was amazing. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if there was a good 6 months before it even came out in the UK. So, so that side of it was a lot more exciting because you just had access to good games.
Yeah.
Far quicker than what they were coming out over here.
And I know there's a feature, a regular feature in the magazine now about, well, old game magazines and sort of staff thereon. And were you reading the magazines back then as well? Or?
Oh, yeah. So the very first magazine I ever bought was Amstrad Action, which was Future's first magazine, incidentally.
Yeah, and serendipitous.
Then I picked up like things like CMVG because they had really good console coverage.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with Mean Machines. I then moved over to Mean Machines Sega because I thought the official Nintendo magazine was not very good. It just didn't have any of the humor or spikiness. Obviously, it couldn't because it was an official mag now. But I didn't like it, so I kind of like embraced the Sega side of it. I'm a big fan of Super Play. I loved N64 for the first 20 odd issues, and then I stopped reading it after the Zelda 2-part review for Ocarina of Time. I would read Edge. I would basically buy anything which covered as many different consoles as possible. So I didn't really have many single format magazines because I was always interested about games, even if I didn't own that system, because I just liked games.
It's interesting what you say about the attitude, because for me that was so paramount with those old magazines, because I mean, like I said, things like Sega Power and Total that I was looking at either buying or getting handed down most often. I mean, with respect to everyone who worked for them, because you know I've worked with some of those people now, which was insane to do. But the journalism, like that was like, that's whatever. What I'm there for is this is funny. This has an attitude. This makes me like smile. You know. And do you think that's something that does carry forward in Retro Gamer?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say we're a particularly funny magazine. Nick used to write most of the funny stuff in the mag, and sadly, he's obviously unable to do that anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was like that. That was not to dwell on too much, but obviously, I'm really sorry about that because that was we communicated obviously, and Nick's lovely, you know.
Yeah, and just in case your readers are wondering who Nick is, Nick was our features editor. He was features editor for 13 years, and he sadly died 1st of December last year.
Yeah, it's shocking.
Yeah, I mean he was in his late 30s, and it was horrendous. It was really difficult for all the staff to get through. And you know, obviously his parents were devastated by it, and he left a huge hole in the magazine because he wrote most of our cover features. He was an intrinsic part of the mag, and he's now gone. And It's well, he's not gone entirely, because I actually have his card from where we went to his funeral, and I have that on my desk, so I get to see him every day.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really sad that stuff like that happens to the nicest of people. And yeah. Nick was, you know, what he didn't know about video games, like his nickname at work was Nickipedia, because he had so much knowledge. And it's absolutely devastating that he's no longer with us. And yeah, most of the humor of the man came from him and his political leanings. And yeah, it's a shame. So I like to style it more on the original Meme Machines and arcade. They were probably the mags that I most enjoyed. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say. Hopefully, we don't overpower the editorial on that. I mean, people obviously know that I like Strider and I like shmups, and people would know that Nick loved Sega.
Yeah,
and people will start understand that, like, Martin likes footy and horror. So we obviously put our personalities into the magazine, but you know, I think we're past that time where the people who wrote the magazines were just as important to the mag success as now. It's a different time.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the reasons why we like to do magazine craft and interview these people is because, you know, to a lot of people, these people were rock stars, and you had them in your house every month, and you got to know them intimately. You got to know what they liked, what they didn't like. So articles like Magazine Craft have proven really popular because it allows people to reconnect with those people that they once loved reading their words back in the day.
I suppose maybe humor is the wrong word for me to use, but I think that the magazine does carry forward that sort of enthusiasm and the joy of it all. You know, it's in, well, not just in the writing, but, you know, in the stories they get told. You know, like, basically they're not getting told anywhere else, and British, in particular, game dev, a lot of crazy things happen, as you know.
Yeah.
So I will ask, actually, as you mentioned this, have you had any sort of dream interviews? What have been, like, your big ones on the magazine?
Probably the biggest ones for me personally was getting hold of the Stampers.
Yeah.
Well, I say Stampers, Chris Stamper. That was a very long, drawn out back and forth for several months. But at the time, we were one of the only people to interview them. John Schipaniak sorted me out with an interview with Yotsui, who did Strider, which is my favorite game.
Yeah.
So that was a personal high point. And also, I got to meet like people like David Braben and chat to them. Because again, Elite wasn't a game that I was good at, but I have a lot of good memories because I used to go around a friend's house and play it, and they're no longer with us. So that was nice to return to that. And you're kind of like, you know, I'll ask the questions that Daniel would have wanted to know. But generally, I kind of lived more through the success of everybody else, because where our magazine is largely done by freelancers, and it's the freelancers who do most of the heavy lifting, they're the people who have been able to get amazing interviews, like for Pac-Man and for Space Invaders and for Outrun and all the rest. So I've managed to get a few personal highlights myself, but generally, as I mentioned before, I don't really write to the extent that I used to. So I don't really interview people in the same way that I used to.
How much were you writing in the early days, out of curiosity?
A fair amount. I think for the first couple of issues, there wasn't anybody on the mag other than me. And then I think John might have come in on issue 20 or 21, maybe. So I might have been writing 40 pages at some point. I don't write anywhere near as that now. And like I said, I very, very rarely do cover features. I think the last cover feature I wrote was a piece about Super Metroid.
Oh, yeah, which that was a while ago, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm lucky enough that there are plenty of talented readers out there and writers out there who do all the heavy lifting for us, and that's always been the case with the mag. The budget has always gone on freelance, because the more budget you can give to freelancers, the more interesting stories you can get, and the more variety you can get into the magazine. And ultimately, I think it's the variety, and I think it's the stories that we get.
Yeah.
Is one of the reasons why the magazine continues to be such a big success.
So it's you and Edge now, right, on the shelves?
Us, Edge, and PC Gamer.
PC Gamer. Apologies to PC Gamer if you're listening. Of course, PC Gamer, yeah. And those are all future, right?
Yeah, and then you've got obviously lots of independent magazines like, I think, Crash and Zap.
Oh, yeah, and Fusion as well, yeah.
I think they're available in places like, well, whatever WH Smith's is called now, and I think you've got things like Pixel Addict and Amiga Addict.
Amiga Addict, yeah.
They're all very different magazines to what we are, yeah. So we don't... I can't speak for them, but we don't see them as competition, because they're obviously offering things that we don't typically do. We're a very console-centric magazine, and that was a purposeful decision that we made when we first started the magazine. We obviously still do home computer stuff, but we focus predominantly on consoles, because ultimately consoles sold more than computers. So yeah. if you've got a choice between putting the Spectrum on the cover or the Super Nintendo, odds are the Super Nintendo, although the Spectrum does very well for us, but the Super Nintendo sold like 30 odd million units, where the Spectrum did maybe 5. So you're just thinking, well, if more people own the SNES, odds are they're going to be more likely to pick up the magazine, because there's more of those people out there. So you're kind of doing it by imposed numbers, as it were.
So I want to talk a little bit about the layout, the visual sort of aspect of the magazine. Now, I know you've mentioned who's in charge of that? Who's doing the layout?
Andy Salter.
Mm. How long have they been doing it for?
Andy's been working on the magazine since, I want to say, issue, I think it was 198.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a great-looking magazine. I think it's been a great-looking magazine since it... I mean, I'm not saying it looked bad at live, but it definitely didn't look like it looked at Imagine and now Future.
So I think one of the things with live, and again, this isn't, like you said, it's not disparaging, because it's what they were going for. They wanted... My understanding is that they wanted to have it look like an old-school magazine.
Yeah.
So the design layouts and the color choices and everything else, that was really intentional.
There were like fake blemishes and like faded parts and stuff, right?
Yep. Yeah. I think the very first issue they scuffed up all the cover and that, so it looked like a load of people had like trodden on and that. They were going for a very specific look, and when you look at the fact that they were covering lots of home computery stuff as well, I mean, it kind of made sense based on the magazines that they were aping and that. And then when Imagine took over, Imagine's management, they were very, you know, we want to make this look like a modern games magazine, but it just happens to be talking about old games. Although, interestingly, I don't consider us a games magazine at all. I would actually class us as a knowledge magazine. We have more in common with magazines like All About History and Classic, and Mojo and stuff like that, than we do with like Edge Ever and PC Gamer. The great thing about the magazine is that you can pick up an issue from 10 years ago, and aside from the little bit at the front where the news is, the rest of it will just be relevant, because it was already out of date when it came out.
Yeah. So do you have any like particular sort of guidelines for covers and things? Because you've had some really spectacular covers like over the years. Do you have any favorites over the years from covers? Or
so I think one of my personal favorite was, we did a split run of Capcom covers, and I was able to get a Strider cover, because again, you know, it's obviously my favorite game. I've always been happy when we've been able to get Will Overton art on the cover.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think he's a fantastic artist, and we don't do, you know, if I had my way, we would have had Will doing every cover every month.
Yeah.
But the budget wouldn't have stretched that far, and it probably would have made people, I think there are some people out there who just see Will as a Nintendo guy, even though he's obviously very talented and can do whatever he wants. But there's that thing that, well, Will Overton does this type of artwork. And like Oliver Frey, the late Oliver Frey, who we also used to put his covers on, he does this sort of thing. So, yeah, I think in terms of my favorite covers, definitely Strider. Obviously, issue 19, simply because we, you know, the magazine was back and it was the magazine that I was getting to head. That was really cool. I was really proud of the issue 250, which again was another Will Overton cover. I'm just literally scrolling through a load now and looking at them.
I think it was the Elite cover, the black and white cover, which Vector Lions and was it Elite?
Oh, yeah.
That's the one that I always remember when I think of Retro Gamer. I think of that cover, a spectacular one with I think it was Elite.
Yeah. It was issue 47. And,
oh, that's going way back then.
Yeah, so that's February 2008. And I think that was one of, at the time, I was able to interview both David Braben and Ian Bell. And Ian obviously doesn't do many interviews nowadays. And I certainly don't recall anywhere they've obviously done them together. You know, they were obviously interviewed separately, but I might have forgotten to tell them that the other person was doing the interview.
Oh, wow.
But I may have, but again, we're talking like nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And then as an ego thing, there's been a few times where I've appeared on the cover, typically in Ollie Frey artwork. We did one for 58, which was a take on one of their Christmas covers. And we did the same for, I think, issue 84, which was an old Zap 64 cover that we turned into like a rare cover. And I'm poking through the window where Jazz Rignall was back in the time. So, things like that. But ultimately, most of my favorite games we've been able to do covers of. Outrun 2 was another personal highlight.
Yeah, I hadn't actually noticed that on the 25 years of Rare cover before, so that is great. I really like stuff like that. I mean, again, that does actually call back to me things like having Steve Jarrett and Andy Dyer in total chat, like just appearing in and around the magazine. It just creates this kind of sense of community, which I think is really appreciated in these UK mags, which actually brings me to something I did want to ask about. I'm not sure if it's an extensive answer, but so does the magazine like travel? Because I know I've bought copies in America before when I've been overseas. But do you have like an American readership as well?
We do. It's not particularly huge. I think it's you could buy it from Barnes and Noble at one point.
Mm.
The magazine turns up in loads of weird places though. I don't deal with the distribution side too much, but.
Yeah.
I've seen readers find it in Japan, which is quite bizarre because it's obviously not translated into Japanese.
Mm.
But Retro Gamer has been licensed out. So there is like a German edition. There was a French edition. I'm not sure if that's still around. There was a Spanish edition. So I'd imagine our versions won't be there because you're effectively competing against the licensed version. But yeah, the magazine does get around. But I think we're very lucky in that something like 80% of our readership are subscribers. And if you work in magazines, that is a very, very good position to be in because obviously magazines are a very volatile industry to be in.
Are you still doing the subscriber covers or...?
Yeah. So there'll be two types of covers, and one will be exclusive for subscribers, and then the other one will be newsstand. And then very occasionally, we do a split run, and we've actually got a split run coming up for the cover we're working on at the moment.
Something else I'll ask about, just another aspect of the magazine, is your supplements that you've had, because I remember this is going back to live publishing, but I always thought it was remarkable that basically a new issue of Zap 64 was produced, because that was before it was, I think it was Zap 64 actually. This is my memory playing tricks on me. It may have been Sinclair using that, I think about it.
I think all of those were during the live publishing era.
I remember that, but you did a Super Play, didn't you?
Yeah, so we did a Super Play. So that's quite an interesting story, because Edge's Tony Mott actually handled that. So I think Nick took screenshots for it, but it was all done largely via Tony, and he got a bunch of separate freelancers. So that, I think that was early on in the magazine, when the magazine was first under Future.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only time when we've actually bought back a classic magazine.
Oh, wow.
Otherwise, what we tend to do now is the smaller 32-page booklets.
Yeah.
And they'll cover all sorts of subjects. And we've got one coming out shortly, actually, which is going to be about the Super Nintendo. And they're done in-house, so me and Martin Carroll will typically put those together in a week.
A week?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's easy.
So the process for one of those, is that just something where you just decide, okay, we're doing one of these for this issue? How regularly do you do those?
So we do premium issues probably three times a year.
Yeah.
There's one normally around November, which comes with a calendar.
Yeah.
And then we normally do one around March, and we normally do one around June. I'd imagine it's one of those things where if it was viable for us to do them every month, then because they sell well. But it's that whole thing of you don't want the magazine to just be all about the gifts.
You want
to be sure that people are buying the mag for the right reason. And so We may go up to four a year, but at the moment I feel three's fairly good. And what we've started doing lately is the last few issues have been coming with like a double-sided poster and a 32-page book. We've done a few CDs in the past, but again, they can be quite difficult and pricey to pull off. And
yeah, that was a feature for the live years, the DVD every issue. I remember that, but then they obviously stopped with Imagine, which frankly was sensible.
Yeah,
as I enjoyed them, that it did seem sensible.
Well, I think the problem with them is A, the licensing side.
Yeah.
Just would have been a nightmare to continue, and it just felt like a real headache to deal with. So it was easier to just like stop doing them and drop the price by a quid. Obviously, the magazine has since risen in price, but we've had a fairly low price range, considering we've been around for 22 years now, and we're about I think we're £6 now for the base mag, going up to £7 when it's a premium issue.
Yeah, which honestly, for a sort of new stand magazine, honestly is really not bad. I would argue, considering what like the other magazines I buy cost.
Yeah, and when you look at some of our competitors. Well, some of the other retro mags, and when you look at the prices of them compared to the page counts and all the rest, yeah, I do think what we charge is fairly reasonable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a pretty dense like magazine with stuff. It's a packed magazine. That's something that's always impressed me since Imagine sort of came in. It really, even with the introduction of like I'm drawing a blank on the name of this feature, for which I apologize, but when you'd get the sort of really gorgeous double page sort of screenshots,
the retro revival,
that's the one. Yeah And I remember initially cynically thinking, oh, this is just like this is them taking out space, you know, and then I look at it now and I just think kind of no, I think the balance is great. Like, you've got the detailed features, you know, it's not in any way sort of shortchanged. But I mean, that must have been a decision, like, to overhaul the visuals, the layout in that respect, because I remember the first, this is going way back up, obviously, but the first Imagine issue, I'm fairly sure in your editorial it says, we want this to be something you'd proudly display on your coffee table.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah.
because it went glossy for a start. Like it was, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it was more because obviously this is from the company who were making games magazines like Games TM.
Yeah.
And so it was more to be like you know, like a sister mag to Games TM in that, yeah. You know, it had the same kind of production values and all the rest. I don't think we quite got there because we tend to ignore a lot of the cardinal don't do. So we'll have a lot of colors painted on other colors that you shouldn't do. We're not as clean as a lot of the other magazines because we like to use lots of like sprite work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But again, I think that's one of the things that does separate us from all the other magazines. Like even when you go back 10 years and there are a lot more video game magazines around than there are now, we were all almost like a riot of color and madness compared to the more like white backgrounds of so many of the other magazines.
I must ask, during sort of the time that you've worked on the magazine, have there been any sort of major sort of kind of, well, apart from the obvious, which you've discussed already, the biggest challenges, the biggest kind of crossroads, or has it been just pleasant? I mean, more or less.
I think things change based on time. Like one of our biggest issues when the magazine first started was getting access to Japanese developers.
Mm.
And that's become a lot easier now. Like we recently did obviously Shadow of the Colossus.
Yes.
And we've done things like Metroid and Sega, typically very supportive of us.
Is it a sort of a longevity thing that there's just more kind of knowledge of the magazine out there? So it's easier to people will respond, oh, yes, I know this magazine, yes.
I think so, but also as well, retro is in a far more exploitive place than it was like 10 years ago. And, you know, that's not to say that everybody's into retro for the wrong reasons, but, you know, it's obvious now that you can make money in the retro gaming market where once upon a time you couldn't. Like, I mean, if you've only got to look at the cover discs that Life Publishing used to give away where they had like, Gremlin and Codemasters, and to my knowledge, they weren't paying for those. They were just like it was literally given away. Whereas that's not going to happen now because obviously these publishers know exactly what their back catalogs are worth, and if there's a way that you can obviously like release a SNES mini or a compilation.
Well, yeah, I mean the LamaSoft disc that was given away with Live, that's now Gold Masters series. That's the Jeff Minter story, you know.
Yeah, and when you look at some of these compilations, and I'm not going to name names, but it does seem easier now to just bring out a compilation of anything, and it will sell just because it's retro, not necessarily because it's a good collection of games or has had a good amount of work put on it, like the Digital Eclipse stuff.
In a way, it's a blessing and a curse because there are games coming out that I never thought would ever get re-released because why would they get re-released? And they happen to be the ones that I'm obsessed with for whatever reason. But that's only happened a few times. Retro gaming must have been, I guess, fortunate in some respect because, as you mentioned, retro gaming has grown and grown. And when it started, it was still sort of fundamentally niche, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, that must have been interesting, sort of being essentially there to chronicle that entire process. Like that, if you go back through the Retro Gamer archives, you must essentially just have a complete history of retro gaming as a... I mean, not of retro games, but of retro gaming as a scene, right? Like, that. It's almost like the... biography of the entire hobby.
Yeah, I like one of the things we used to do is we used to have a section early on in the mag where readers were heavily involved,
yeah.
And we would all be on the forum and we'd all play a game together, and there would just be loads of comments from everybody talking about the game and where they got to it and stuff. And obviously, in today's environment, you can't do that because forums just really aren't a thing now.
Yeah.
You obviously get a few which are popular. But generally, like, Retro Gamer doesn't have its own forum now because it just turned into a ghost town. Mm-hmm. Everybody is on Blue Sky and everybody is on, like, X and Facebook. And it's not, you can't really have those conversations in the same way. They're not as easy to, like, reply to and everything else. So you've definitely seen a change there. You've seen changes with regards to how popular digital stuff has become. Like, the virtual console was really good, and now Nintendo's realized that they can probably make a lot more money by just gatekeeping these games behind, like, a subscription paywall.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's changed. Sony do something similar where most of their classic stuff is, again, my understanding is it's part of a subscription package where you can, like, play loads of classic stuff. If you can obviously buy individual stuff, then that's great, because I think that's what you should be allowed to do.
Yeah.
As a gamer, I'm all about freedom of choice. And while I'm aware that there are plenty of people who will never buy digital games, it's nice to have the option to do so rather than just having to, like, stick with a paywall. Like, the virtual console was fantastic.
Yeah.
I had so many games on the virtual console. I absolutely loved it. You know, obviously, I was lucky enough to get a lot of review codes, but I would happily buy plenty of stuff myself. And I think when, for me personally, when it's kind of like behind a paywall, it doesn't feel as important to me because I'm not really investing any money into one specific thing.
Yeah, I do get that. I mean, I think that the Nintendo Switch Online, like, I think the selection now is excellent that they offer.
I barely
use it because it's not mine.
And again, that's not me saying, like, I think it's a terrible service. I think good service. I just wish that you had the option to still buy games, like, even if it was a case of we'll let you buy this game at a discount or something. But it's just a shame. And but again, it's just the way things are going. And, you know, if you look at how compilations have changed, you know, once upon a time, a good documentary was a rarity in a compilation.
Yeah.
But now, for me, Digital Eclipse have become the company. They're the yardstick. Them and M2, that's who you rate stuff by. And if you are brave enough to release a bunch of games which don't have any, like, historical content with them, your games better be bloody good, because the whole process of how those compilations are perceived now has changed massively.
Yeah, I mean, you get, like, Digital Eclipse setting sort of essentially the gold standard, no pun intended, there. I mean, their Mortal Kombat compilation they just brought out, I thought was absolutely incredible. With the sheer amount of options, the sheer amount of ways to enjoy those games. I mean, I thought they presented those games in a way where, even if, you know, with respect to their place and time, if they aren't great games, they provide as many ways as possible for you to enjoy them and to appreciate them. And then you've got, for example, Cubite, who are sort of sub-licensing Pico's stuff and just releasing it kind of broken. it really does seem to be a bit of a sort of a Wild West in a way.
There's a big gulf, and like I said, it feels now that we are getting to a point, and, you know, this goes the same, not just compilations, this goes the same for actual physical releases of single games. Like I can understand why people would want something like Wild Guns, because the original game is now prohibitively expensive, and it's a fantastic game, but I'm pretty sure I just saw that Zool is being re-released on the Mega Drive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who, you know, is there an actual audience for that? Is there an audience for, like,
well,
physical Bubsy games? And if there is that a sustainable enough audience?
I mean, speaking for myself, I was a fan of the Zool Redimensioned that they put out. But the idea of re-releasing Zool on a Mega Drive cartridge as a kind of a limited premium thing just gets me thinking, like, well, I bought a copy of Zool on eBay for Fiverr. Like, yeah, that's not rare. I can just buy that. Like,
yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? I think where these publishers, the likes of Limited Run Games, Strictly Limited, and everyone else who are doing them, I think the benefits come from when you are making something available, which is prohibitively hard to get, yeah, either because it hasn't been re-released on anything on modern systems, or because it will cost you like thousands or hundreds of pounds to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think stuff like that is a really good idea. And I know that, again, there will be some hardcore collectors who consider them to be no more than bootlegs because they're not being officially sanctified by Nintendo or Sega or whoever. But, you know, these companies don't make these games, so yeah, they can't grant an official license. But if you're doing everything properly and you're going to whoever owns the license of the game now, even if it might not be the original developer or the original publisher,
yeah,
it's still being done properly, and you should probably support that because it just means that more potential retro stuff is going to come along.
Yeah.
Hence why obviously a lot of people are so excited about the Neo Geo AES Plus that's coming out, because, you know, most people have always dreamed of owning a Neo Geo collection, and games like Metal Slug are, you know, they cost thousands.
Yes.
So the fact that you'll be able to buy it for 70 quid, you know, that's making, yeah, a lot of people happy.
Yeah, I was excited on a lesser scale of price, but the Code Mystics Neo Geo Pocket collections they've been doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, it's a great way of, they're well emulated. It's a great way of getting access to otherwise expensive games. And again, even though they're not quite on par with the Digital Eclipse stuff in terms of the history side of it, they're still very succinct packages.
Yeah.
And you know, they're really good. I mean, I still maintain that Rare Replay is one of the best compilations that's ever been made.
Yeah.
And the main reasoning behind that is not just because of the games that have been chosen, but when you look at a lot of these compilations, they're always a fixed point in time.
Yeah.
And Rare was obviously the first. This was the first one to like do like everything. Go starting off from the 8-bit days to the Xbox 360.
Yeah, it's,
and you
wild,
you are,
yeah,
starting to see that now with like but you know, even when you've had like Digital Eclipse doing like their SNK one, it was all like the pre-SNK stuff, the pre-Neo Geo, sorry. And
yeah,
when Capcom have done it, they've typically done like either the CPS era stuff or stuff before it. They rarely put it all together. So it's happening more now. But
yeah,
that first Rare compilation felt like a proper journey for a company's past, and it was, it was amazing.
So,
and you know, that would have been unthinkable 10 years before that came out.
And I mean, of course, we have got Evercade now.
Yeah. Evercade are doing fantastic. It's kind of like the company that was Blaze Entertainment. I think it's a different company and the name has carried over, but they did try to do something similar, but it was going to be more download based. But yeah, again, what they're doing is superb. They're at their best when they're making games like Toplin and Neo Geo, making them readily available.
Yeah.
And you just want more of that happening, because I think Frank Cifaldi and his team, they've done a really, really good job of highlighting just how many games aren't available.
Yeah.
So the more stuff that can come back, the better it is for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I've been like standing Evercade, I guess you could say. What with them putting things out like the Duke Nukem collections, where it's,
yep,
not so much to, I mean, not only do you get like, you know, the reprogrammed like 60 FPS version of that DOS game. You know, I grew up with that game and I've never seen it run that well. And I don't think that's been re-released anywhere else yet. but then also getting those less played PS1 versions of those games, Land of the Babes, Time to Kill, and putting those out again so people can go, oh, hang on, this is actually good. This isn't trash. This deserves attention. I mean, I have a, this is a slightly optimistic view maybe, but I have a sort of basic, a basic premise where whatever a game scored back in the day in, like, say, for example, official PlayStation magazine, just add 2 to whatever that was, and that's the real score now. Even if it's a 10, it's a 12 now, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, you quickly, as much as scores would govern, like, my purchases as a kid,
yeah,
you obviously start realizing, particularly once you get in the industry and you, like, you understand the people who are writing stuff and you get to know what their tastes and everything else are. But ultimately, even when you look at, like, with Edge now, and there's still plenty of great debate around, like, Edge scores and that, but ultimately it's just one person's opinion.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's obviously not to say that they're wrong. And, you know, when you've got a magazine like Edge and you're that revered, I'd imagine it's quite a weight when you're giving out things like tens. Whereas with Retro Gamer, I'm sure that there are some people who are interested in our reviews, but I can absolutely guarantee that nobody is buying our magazine for the reviews.
Mm.
So, you know, they're not as important. They don't carry, like, a Retro Gamer 90% isn't going to carry the same weight as an Edge 9 or an Edge 10. It just isn't, right, because obviously we don't have that prestige associated with us like Edge does.
Do you have your own little badge, like the Sizzler? Do you have that?
Yeah, well, funny enough, we still use it.
I thought you did. That's why it was in my head. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's called the Retro Gamer Sizzler, yes, rather than obviously. But yeah, it's fundamentally the same logo we've been using since the magazine came out.
Excellent.
Like since the rebirth. So
yeah,
since 2005.
Yeah, that is excellent. I love that. One other thing I wanted to ask you, because I'll let you dash off shortly, but are you still doing the bookazines, the annuals, the collections?
I don't do as many as I used to. They're still very, very, very popular for the company, so there are still plenty on the shelves. I tend to only do the annual, which is like the, you know, here's the best bits of the mag.
Yeah.
And generally, I would just be behind the scenes saying, like, you know, blah, 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 I think this would be a good book. Or somebody might come to me and say, oh, you know, we like the idea of doing something on this. What kind of content have you got? Because obviously, from their point of view, the more content they can reuse before they have to start freelancing it out, the more profitable it is for them.
I mean, yeah, the archive's so huge, like, just like so many pages of stuff that could be republished, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, one of our old bosses, he once said, Aaron Asadi, and he once did a big piece in front of everybody, and they went with the word content is king.
Mm.
And that really is correct, and that really helped imagine. One of the things that made us so desirable to future was the bookazine side of the business, and yeah, that is still massively popular now. It's evolved beyond what it was, where it was largely reprinted material, and now they'll create a lot of brand new stuff. But that whole thing was always there. That thing Aaron said has always stuck with me, that, you know, content is king. And you know, Retro Gamer will happily, if we're doing a book, will happily take an old interview from the magazine from, like, say, 15 years ago, because there's a good chance that a reader picking up the magazine today won't necessarily have read it. And if you've got a great making of Outrun, why would you commission somebody to write a new one? Just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's the nature of the sort of, obviously the nature of the magazine is reasonably sort of ephemeral. Like, it's not like, I mean, you can get them as PDFs now. That I assume that's not something I pay attention to. But I mean, like, you can buy them digitally now, right? The magazines.
Yeah. So if you take out a subscription, you'll get access to the entire back catalog, back to, I think, issue 134 to present.
Oh, wow.
As long as your subscription continues. But otherwise, you can, obviously, you should be able to still buy individual issues if you wish to. But you know, you should be buying a physical magazine because physical magazines are great. We all love thumbing through through physical mags.
Yeah. I mentioned that as a solid because like one of the magazines I do still buy, Classic Pop magazine, had a similar sort of a deal where if you like subscribe, they would just give you like access to their big archive. And I mean, having access to Retro Gamer going back to 1-3-4, I mean, that's an astonishing amount of material. Like,
yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, sometimes it bites you in the bum. Like we've occasionally had people say like, "Oh, I can't believe you've done this on the cover, or you've just written about this because." I've literally just read that feature, and then it turns out that the feature they're referring to is something that they picked up off their shelf from 8 years ago, and happens that they read it as we've just covered, like, Robotron again or something. So yeah. we get that occasionally, but ultimately, you know, it's a good position to be in.
I mean, and you know, I'm really grateful for your time, and I do love the magazine, and I'm really grateful for you printing things that I did back in the day, and I hope to do again at some point.
Oh, absolutely! Well, they were good pieces, and and again, you know, I was really pleased with the Pitfall one because it meant that I didn't have to write it.
Oh,
so,
God. That was serendipity, though, because I love that game. It was wait, are you serious? Like, you want that?
Yeah.
Oh my God! Yeah, that was wild.
I mean, things like that are still fun. Like, you know, there's still plenty of games out there that I used to enjoy playing, and every now and then I'll get into full, like, investigative journalist mode, and I'll track down people about a certain game that I liked and see if I can do a piece on it. And sometimes they want to talk, sometimes they don't want to talk, you know.
Yeah.
So you'll always find stuff. And the great thing is that obviously as the magazine is continuing,
yeah,
newer stuff is getting older, so then you can cover it in the magazine.
It's the same with Retronauts. We have a basic running rule of thumb, which is if it's 10 years old, it's now retro. So we have no fear. We have stories for years, to quote The Simpsons. I hope there'll be issues for years. You know, you want to be the guy working on EGM or whatever it was. Like, you want that guy's crowns.
Yeah. And I think we had a similar thing. Like, we used to have a 10-year point.
Yeah,
and then when obviously the 360 and the PS3, when they kind of extended their lifespans, we upped it to 15.
Yeah,
because generally the reason we always went for 10 years to begin with is that would typically be the space of two console generations.
Yeah, it's so different now. Absolutely, yeah.
Whereas obviously everything seems to be hanging around for longer, but you know, we have a lot of. We have a lot of passionate readers. So when something like Half-Life 2, for example, appears on the cover, and if somebody does say, well, that's not retro, somebody will say, well, actually, this game is older than, like, say, Manic Miner was when it first appeared on the cover and things like that. So, because again, it's all about context. And ultimately,
sure.
everybody's conception of what retro is like completely different anyway.
I mean, just yesterday at the Sony State of Play when they announced the Rayman Legends remake, I was like, they can't remake that. They just came out, and it turns out that came out 13 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, I've turned it into a skeleton. That's good.
Well, yeah. I'm in a very weird situation now where I'm talking retrospectively about things that I reviewed in the magazine when they first come out, so that's weird.
So Retro Gamer itself has become retro, and there will now be a magazine called Retro Game, like Retro Gamer. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean that would be quite funny, wouldn't it? Like, we obviously have, we used to have the Back to the Noughties, and we did used to put the magazine in there, but it felt really, really strange, so we just stopped doing it.
I just love that because I think it was Back to the 80s when it started, that feature. And that was in the live years. And that must be the longest serving feature, or is that Desert Island Discs? I should have asked this ages ago, shouldn't I? What is the longest serving recurring feature?
The longest recurring feature is definitely the making of.
Because
we've been doing those pretty much since issue 20, I think. Speaking about Back to the 80s, because obviously that finished, because I think we stopped at about 8 years ago when we ran out of months. Yeah. However, as of the issue which is on shelves Thursday, we are going back to the 80s.
Oh, wow.
So we're starting right from the beginning, because when we first did it, we kind of did like a haphazard month. So one issue might be August 1983, and then the next issue would be December 1980. So we're starting right from the beginning, January 1980, and the entire two-page look is completely different to what we used to do. So we'll be interested to see how that goes, and hopefully, if there's a good reception for that, we'll go back to the 90s as well.
Can I ask what the cover is for that issue? Because I think this won't be out till that's out, so I think you're in the clear.
So that issue has got the Commodore 64 on the cover. So ooh, lovely. It's we recently did a legacy of the Spectrum.
Yes.
So we're now doing a legacy of the Commodore 64.
Excellent. Excellent. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And I'm going to keep reading, and I hope it sticks around for many years to come. And I hope print doesn't die.
And me too. Me too. Ideally, I'd like to be still doing this before I retire, because I'm pretty sure I've got some good making of PS5 games in me at some point.
Yeah.
But we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Because when you said that like something like 80% of the readership was subscribing, I was genuinely like, oh, that's good, because Prince, like the shelf space is like, I mean, or the WH Smith like exploding. That doesn't seem, I mean, it seems like another poor, sort of bad portent for print media.
Yeah, I mean, I've always, the
not
analogy
to, not to
I've
end
always
on a down note, incidentally, I apologise, but...
No, I mean, it's the way it is, but the analogy I've always used is that if you look at magazines, we're like the little birds, which are on the back of like rhinos and elephants, and pick away at them. Because basically we have this symbiotic relationship where obviously we have this space to sell our magazines, and then people obviously buy the magazines.
Yeah.
But all of these shops are dying off, so there's got to be nowhere to fly to. So you have to either obviously hope that you have a good subscriber base.
Yeah.
Or you have to find ways to potentially maybe turn your content into digital content.
Mm.
But yeah, it's been challenging in magazines for probably the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't get any easier. And you know, the same obviously goes for websites as well. It's like,
yes.
It's if you do love print magazines or any sort of physical media, the best thing you can do is to obviously go out and buy it, because you know, the amount of times, and you've probably seen this as well, that when a magazine gets shut down or a company stops making something, and everybody goes like, I wish I'd carried on buying it. And it's like, yeah. Well, that's why it's shut down, because if people don't buy it,
mm-hmm.
and you see all this lament, and it's like, well, you know, if you don't get to that stage, just like keep on supporting. And, you know, I'm not saying that you need to support us, but if there's something physical that you enjoy and you get it every month, or you get it bi-monthly or whenever, keep buying it, because it won't be around forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I'll leave it on that note. Naughties, everyone go and subscribe to Retro Gamer, please. And thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was me talking to Darren Jones of Retro Gamer Magazine. I hope you will all go out and check out the magazine if you haven't, and subscribe if you haven't, and resubscribe if you're already subscribed. I think generally it's a force for good, and I'm amazed. Well, actually, that sounds rude. I was about to say I'm amazed it's lasted this long. No, you know what? I am. I am amazed it's lasted this long. But as we talked about in the episode, Retro Gamer kind of got there and was there as retro gaming became more and more of a thing. You could say I was a major contributor to that. There's a lot of things I think Retro Gamer has been very influential in. But you've heard the interview now, and this is just the outro. Yeah, I like the magazine very much. I'm excited that I got to talk to Darren. I feel like I should have got round to it quite a lot earlier. But it's happened now. It's happened. Yeah, go check it out.
And thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope the fact that I'm very bad at doing intros and outros hasn't soured the experience in any way. You know, I was having some, I'm going to talk about this. I was having some audio issues recording these intros and outros. And Greg, the editor, was like, you know, more politely than this, was like, Stu, this audio sucks and you suck. He didn't say that, obviously. I made that part up. But so I'm looking into this, and I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on with my audio. And I recently got a new computer, so I'm thinking it's obviously some setting that I've missed. And it turns out that Audacity, which I record these on, it was set to record from my webcam rather than my microphone, which was... I was like, okay, great, cool. Problem solved. There we go. That sorted the problem. Except for, you know, one very small factor, which is... I don't have a webcam, so I don't know what the hell is recording me. I think I'm being spied on. I think it might be Diamond Fight doing it, but I've got no evidence for that whatsoever. Diamond doesn't seem like the sort of person who would spy on someone, but for some reason it's just like, that's the vibe that I'm getting. So yeah, watch out. Watch out for them. Watch out. Okay, I'm off. This is a Patreon episode, so there's no need for me to do all the plugs. You're already on the Patreon. You're already good people. Thank you, and goodbye, and there'll be another episode along in a week, which probably has a much better intro than this one, and outro.